Good evening and welcome to the September 19th, 2017 meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District Board of Trustees. We met in closed session and we considered three possible items of litigation. Now we have an opportunity to comment on the order of business. Does anyone have a... No? We're good? Okay. When we're moving on then to the approval of minutes for September 5th, 2017.
I move approval of the minutes for September the 5th.
I move approval of the minutes for September the 5th.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Mr. Quisenberry and a second by Mr. Buckman. Approval of minutes for 9/5/17. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And that passes 7-0.
We have an abstention.
And one abstention. 6 with one abstention. And we have the same approval of minutes for 9/14/17.
I'll move approval.
We have a motion by Mrs. Roger and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And now we move on to, and that passes 7-0. We move on to our student representative, singularly.
Hi, everyone. Hope you're doing well. So last week was a big week in sports for San Luis Obispo High School. We had a away game at Morro Bay where our boys took home a W. Pearson Mosichuk basically carried our team into the win, but he had 2 touchdowns, I think somewhere around 300 yards, and we won 24-10. At the end of the game, our students rushed the field, and Coach Johnston gave a speech. He said that school spirit directly correlates with how sports teams are doing, and the school spirit that I've seen yesterday and today, it's been higher. There's always... our other sports teams are doing well as well, and it's always nice to see our sports get so much support. I mentioned inclusivity at the last board meeting, and I'm going to try relating what I report, or most of what I report, to that central theme. Coach Johnston has been one person who thinks that inclusivity is also important. He pulled me aside last year after I was elected and said, I want you to make sure that school spirit is high to make sure my boys know that their school supports them. And that's exactly what we saw on Friday. And it was honestly the best feeling ever. We also had a rally on Friday. It was medieval themed. People showed up wearing togas, dressed as princesses, princes. I personally wore an Indian prince costume, so I had a turban on. I had these little pointy shoes and a long dress, basically. But at this rally, we recognized honor roll students, how well our FFA is doing, which we have around 20 students going to nationals this year, which we've been basically doing really well in every single year. We had our Parley Pro team get first in nationals last year and the year before. We also recognized our sports, of course. One thing that we've started to broaden is at our rallies, instead of calling them spring sports rallies or fall sports rallies, the term we've coined is spring recognition rally. We continue to improve on recognizing all of our students' accomplishments. We've started including drama, our plays, FFA, honor roll students, Skills USA, having all the students stand up so they get recognized at these rallies, and not just sports. And of course, sports does get recognized, but we're just broadening it. We've announced our homecoming theme at that rally in a video. Our homecoming week is October 2nd through the 6th with our dance on the 7th. The seniors will be sci-fi. Oh, excuse me. It's Hollywood. The seniors will be the sci-fi genre, juniors fantasy, sophomores western, and the freshmen musicals. On Friday, October 6th, we have a parade that goes through downtown, and each of the classes have their own float, which they decorate throughout the week after school, and that's a great way for our community to get involved. Our community relations person this year has been trying to get different members of the community. We're trying to get Heidi Harmon, some clubs from Cal Poly to work in conjunction with our clubs on campus to make their own floats or walk with our students to, and our, include the community. We have a student congress meeting tomorrow. This is our chance for ASB students, at least, to get feedback from the students in the school. Every single second period class chooses one representative to basically go to lecture demo room and voice their opinion. So we have around 60-odd students show up and basically give feedback on what ASB is doing, and of course admin and the athletic director to ask them questions about whatever is going on at the school. It's usually about bathrooms, which gets put onto Measure D. No offense, Mr. O'Connor. Moving on. We lunchtime activities. So we have a leadership class this year, which is basically more freshman and sophomore. It's like a stepping stone onto the ASB class in the future. So their first period and ASB's third period, they've been tasked with having lunchtime activities every Tuesday and basically being in charge of some spirit days. This is really important to ASB because ASB does work a lot with a lot of different things, and it's nice to have that leadership class there providing support with things that we can't always work on. So they work on lunchtime activities, and that's just one way for us to always make sure the students sitting on campus that can't go off or don't have a car to go off or basically any that bring a lunch, they have something to do on campus. We also have intramurals running this week. So our first intramural of the year is spike ball. Our intramurals commissioners put it on, and teams of two sign up, and whoever wins gets a T-shirt and recognition in the bulletin. It's just a fun way for, once again, students to do something during lunch. This month, you may know, is National Hispanic Heritage Month. Last week on Friday, our Mecha Club played music in the quad during lunch, and it's the first time I've ever seen that many students come up in the quad and start dancing. It was really cool to see. Like, it's the first time ever I've actually seen it just happen. We had, I want to say, 50 students dancing to the Cupid Shuffle. It was cool seeing our freshmen, like all of our classes, getting up and just having the time of their lives in the quad. So we hope to keep that going. And Mesha Club will be playing music on Fridays just to honor National Hispanic Heritage Month and running bulletins and giving the students facts in the bulletin, basically. Sports, this week is a big week against Mission. Today, our tennis team played Mission at home. I'm not sure if the outcome of that. I'm sure we won. Our tennis team's amazing. On Thursday, we have another game against Mission. We have another game against Mission, but before the game, we're going to ASB's putting on a tailgate sponsored by the athletic department. We're going to have a student barbecue for students to hang out and have a great time before we go into the game and show support there. And on Friday, we have our next home game for football against Dos Pueblos. That's going to be another game where we try and keep that spirit going, like Mr. Coach Johnston was saying, just to see that correlation between spirit and team performance. Yeah, so that's my report. Sorry for the rambling, but I like hearing myself talk.
We like hearing you talk too, Rutik.
Thank you.
And I love the idea of an ASB farm team. It's a great idea to start bringing those kids along. Mr. Millar?
I thought that would be a great thing for the school board, too. We haven't been able to figure out how to do it. So the tailgate barbecue before the next tennis match, are the Mission students going to participate as well, or is that a river too far so far?
I'm sure anyone is welcome. We've never been exclusive to any students. If your Mission students want to come by and pay.
Okay, we're seeing signals from the staff.
And Richie, as always, you're welcome to stay, or you may go, whichever your duty calls.
Okay, thank you very much.
Calling to you. Thank you. So moving on to correspondence, we did have one letter, which was written to us, and it's a very nice letter. It's from the County Office of Education and Dr. Brescia, and he communicated that he was thankful of our very well-written and successful LCAP and the budget documents and the multi-year projections and the narrative. So we did receive that bit of communication. Anyone have anything else they'd like to add to that? No. Okay. So moving on to public comment, if there's anyone who would like to speak to the board now rather than wait for their item to come up on the agenda, they may do so. Oh, and we do have a taker. Hello.
Hello. Good evening. My name is Janet Gould, and I'm the principal of Del Mar Elementary. Welcome to Del Mar. First, I wanted to thank our amazing community for passing Measure D, and just wanted to come here tonight and thank the board and the district for the amazing work that's been done at Del Mar over the past two summers. The summer before last, there was some really needed repair work on our water lines, and this past summer, they just did a great job of giving the school a whole new fresh look with new paint and removing some wing walls in our hallways to open them up and put up backpack racks, which has been a great big deal for our kiddos. And Michelle, the project manager, and Bruce, our inspector, were great and easy to work with. And Ryan and Anthony were here on the first day of school just checking everything out. And even down to our landscaping at last minute, just doing everything they could to get us off to a great start of the year. And the school looks awesome, and it's just been neat to hear families and kids and parents talk about, you know, how great everything looks. So thank you. We appreciate it.
It does look great, yeah. Mrs. Gould. Thank you. And if there is no one else who would like to speak now, you can also. And we do have someone else who would like to speak.
My name is Carrie Friend. I'm on the Cayuga School Board. I'm not speaking on behalf of them. I am a member. We just had a meeting last week, and you know that we're involved in researching options to have our money follow to San Luis Coastal, where most of your kids go. It was a little disconcerting to hear my superintendent make a statement that he's already made an agreement with Superintendent Prater regarding our IDTs when our decision hasn't even been made on what option that we want. So it kind of seemed to put the cart before the horse, and we're still trying to figure out things to know that there was already an agreement made. That's it.
Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to speak?
Loudest she is always. I'm Charlotte Erlin, and I am here for my second ever school board meeting, and I'm here representing Heidi Harmon. There's three of us that are volunteering to help her be more involved in the school board and kind of put her finger on the pulse of what's going on in the community where she doesn't have, you know, direct jurisdiction. And so I'm one of her fingers, I guess. Hopefully not her middle finger, but I'm one of the fingers, knowing my personality. Anyway, so I'm here for that, and I'm also here to hopefully get more involved in the school board as I have a child that's in first grade at C.L. Smith. So thank you.
Thank you, Charlotte, and you're welcome to be here. and you can comment on any item as it is coming up as well. And there are forms in the back for you to sign up for something that you may think is coming up on the agenda that you would like to speak to. We're now moving to the business and budget update with Mr. Pinkerton.
Well, yeah, there's a bill actually going through the legislature right now, SB 751.
I'll let that one.
Which it looks like CSBA has been able to work well with CTA and come up with a new reserve law. So in terms of school district reserves, so this has been a hot topic over the last few years in terms of reserve levels, those types of things. But this one in particular looks like it's headed to passage. So
it's actually passed, and it's going to the governor, I believe.
Yeah, going to the governor. So in terms of waiting for the governor's signature, but gone through the Assembly, Senate. So it looks good in terms for us as basic aids district. It actually exempts us. From those reserve levels, and so kind of some key things. There's some restrictions in terms of when it actually would get enacted. If it did get enacted, which is a 3% of the general fund, would have to go into the K-12 reserve, which is about $2 billion. Any school district that's less than 2,501 students, as well as basic aid districts, are exempt from the reserve levels. It moves the reserve level to a 10%. Instead of the 3% that it had before. And again, even with all of that, the county office can still exempt school districts for up to 2 years. And it also allows continued defined reserves to continue. So Fund 20, things like that, where school districts may be putting together publicly, putting a fund together for a specific purpose, those things would continue. So we'll be watching that. I'll let the board know if the governor does sign it. But again, CSBA, CTA, looks like they're both kind of behind it, have worked together to get this done. So it's good news for us. And to be honest, I mean, to me, it's just a fiscally responsible bill that makes a lot of sense for a lot of school districts.
So Ryan, did I hear correctly that there would be a 10% cap on LCFF districts?
That's where the new reserve cap would be if the criteria of the 3% of the general $2 billion was put into the K-12 reserve.
So 3% remains the
minimum.
Minimum.
Yes.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Pinkerton. Now we are ready for our educational services update. Mrs. McGrath.
Thank you. Mrs. Gould took the words out of my mouth that Del Mar looks fantastic, so congrats to everyone there. Just a quick reminder that we had a fantastic 9/11 ceremony where we had students from Hawthorne, Sinsheimer, Laguna, and Slo High representatives at the Slo Fire Station. It was just a great opportunity to kind of witness the memorial and remember that day. Also, a reminder that we have our Student Senate. Our superintendent holds a Student Senate tomorrow. That's a fantastic opportunity for our secondary students, both middle school, PAC Beach, as well as our two comprehensive of high schools. We have student representatives that come together and are going to continue the process that was started last year of really gathering their input around topics that are important going on, as well as LCAP feedback. And this is a great opportunity for adults to hear directly from students. So we look forward to starting that process for this year tomorrow.
When and where would that be?
J2, I believe 9 to 12.
Thank you, Mrs. McGrath. Mr. Buckman, did you have a comment? No. Okay. And
I was going to ask the same question.
Okay. Mr. Pinkerton, back to you for Measure D update.
So yeah, Measure D update. We had a great study session. Hopefully the board was pleased in terms of the items going through that, all of our summer projects, kind of upcoming projects. For us, it's kind of a critical week. We're going to find out our GMPs for the Annex project, the new 10 classroom building at San Luis Obispo High School, as well as the J Wing, which is a 6 classroom building at Morro Bay High School. So we're hoping to receive those from Acme Construction Company on Thursday. And all indications in talking to them thus far is they've received most of the bids, or that we look like we're right in that budget, right at our estimate. So that's good news, because we were a little worried about the skilled and trained and what was going to happen with bids because of that. So the good news is, with our lease-back, it looks like they are coming in as expected. So that's a positive sign. We'd always like them less, of course. That would be great, but not, you know, a huge bust in terms of those areas. So I'll be bringing those to the board, so that those will be upcoming. Other than that, kind of key things, Kyle worked with Michelle as well as Stephanie Berto to kind of get ready for our big, huge Morro Bay High School pool grand opening, right? Everyone's excited about talking about. You know, kudos to Michelle and Kyle and the team over there really pushing to get that pool on time, done. You're seeing almost miracles like every day in terms of the changes at the pool and what looks and happens, and so that kind of that finished product comes together. And so really excited about getting that plaster in and water in next week, and the fences are up now, and so it's just very, very exciting, I think, for the entire community. I reached out. We've been talking with the Morro Bay community here in terms of the public component of the pool, and so I had some great discussions. Kyle's been working with the Morro Bay city staff as well, and so just all good feelings. You know, I really feel good about where we're headed with the Morro Bay High School pool.
Fantastic. Thank you, Mr. Baker.
And that's October 6th,
yes.
Grand opening.
Yes.
It's going to happen. We're jumping in the pool.
What?
We're jumping in the water that day. It's going to happen.
Kyle, what time?
3:30.
October 6th, 3:30. We get to watch Mr. Pinkerton jump into the
there
pool.
There will be a lot of media and a lot of press. I'm looking forward to Mr. Quisenberry and his cap again, swim cap. It's going to be very exciting. Very exciting.
Speedo.
Yes.
And Speedo. Okay, Mr. Buckman, you have a comment? No? Okay. All right, then. Thank you very much, Mr. Pinkerton. So we are now moving on to item number 9.01.
You're after me, sorry.
Oh, no, it says here 9.01.
No, 8, resolutions.
So this is the Bellevue St.
Alarm back there. Yes, 8.01. This is the Measure D Bellevue Santa Fe lease.
So Bellevue Santa Fe Elementary School has two projects moving through. One is a classroom replacement modernization as well as the office modernization. Again, kudos to Anthony Palazzo and his staff, as well as Brian Goetz and his staff, in getting that application in to get the state matching funds. It looks really good. We're super positive about it. It looks probably end of October.
January. Yeah. They're
later?
There's a window now.
November, okay. January. All right. So, but still, in terms of the history of that school, where they're at, the grant itself, all the things, really positive. And again, the classroom project is kind of moving forward. We're purchasing the portables. Measure D is helping support that. The state matching funds is going to help complete the entire campus. So with that, in terms of that work, we put out an RFQ-RFP to receive a contract to do a lease-leaseback agreement for that school. In particular, I think at Bellevue, lease-leaseback is really going to be helpful in terms of bringing somebody in early because that is their campus. So we have to make sure that the contractor works directly with the school and that we get those classes online by the start of the school. Mr. Goetz has already been working with his staff and parents about starting the school year a little bit later, extending the window for construction. So doing everything that he can to assist in getting this accomplished. So that said, the RFQ-RFP, we had one respondent, which was Larry Weiss on Construction. They're a firm that does a lot of school construction. They've been kind of second or third in a lot of our previous RFQ-RFPs. Actually really looking forward to working with Weiss on Construction and having another firm come in. They have a firm handle after meeting with them last Friday. Mr. Holcomb, myself, Mr. Palazzo met with Weiss on Construction last Friday, talked. They have a whole plan for skilled and trained, so they're kind of ahead of the game from what we've seen even with some of the other contractors. So we're very excited about having their company on board. And so tonight, this is a resolution for the board to approve Larry Weissong Construction Company coming in and setting up a lease-leaseback agreement with the district. So that's what the resolution is tonight. We will then be coming back to the board with the contract documents at the next meeting. Then ultimately, the construction company will be working with Brian Goetz and our staff to kind of put together the plan. We hope to bid this really early, in particular, to make sure that we have everything in line, because again, this is going to be a summer dynamic project that has to get accomplished during that time. We're already on the list in terms of the classroom manufacturer to make sure that we're in line to get those on time. So everything is, kind of pivotal. This is again ahead of the time. We want to get the construction company on board so that we are clear and we make sure that this is all lined up correctly. So tonight, I'm asking the board to approve the resolution in the selection of Weissong Construction, and then we'll be bringing the actual contract documents to you at probably the next board meeting.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this item? I think it was Mrs. Sheffer who was up first.
Yeah, I'm curious about something. Why do you think there was only one bid? It seems that on our other projects we had multiple.
Mr. Plaza, you want to help me out on that one? Why do you think one bid, Mr. Plaza?
Or just even one response, correct?
Yeah.
I think historically on the bigger projects where there was, 5, 10, 20, $50 million at stake, you got a lot larger firms from a farther spread out area that were coming in and bidding on our projects. I think this one, being the size and scale of it, is more going to lend itself to local. And so, a couple of our other local contractors are pretty busy right now. And so Mr. Weissong was there was a couple local contractors at the job walk, and I think they just kind of opted out given the size, scope, scale of the project. And Mr. Weissong was really interested in working with us, and we've got other jobs coming down the line, so to speak. So
you think we're starting to feel the pinch of other projects in our area, other bonds that were passed projects?
We've been feeling that for a while. But I think, again, this one was not one that you would see people from L.A. and San Francisco come down for.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a quick question, Anthony, before you go away. I'm just thinking that maybe the term lease-leaseback falls on people's ears as unfamiliar. Is there a way you could just give, ever so briefly explain what that means?
It goes back to that, if I had to describe it at a cocktail party, I would probably say it's akin to a lease-to-buy, lease-to-purchase. How it came about back in the 70s was that it allowed for developers to lease school districts' properties, build that school district a school as they were building their development, and then lease that school back to the school district so they could make their payments and have their school as the houses were being developed, rather than build a development, have all these students with an empty lot with a nice sign that says coming in 10 years, the new school. So that was kind of the impetus for it. And so that's kind of how the term lease-leaseback came about, because you're leasing the property to a developer or a contractor in this case, and they lease it back to you with the improvements made. So,
thank you. Well
okay.
done.
Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Pinkerton.
So, yeah, we're asking for approval for the resolution tonight.
I move approval of resolution number 031718.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Mr. Unger, seconded by Mr. Quisenberry. This is a roll call vote.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Quisenberry?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Passes 7-0.
Thank you. And now, you have item number 9.01. Thank you for being so eager.
Good evening. How are you doing tonight?
Very well. Thank you.
Well, first off, I do want to congratulate San Luis Obispo for the victory over Morobe High School this for last Friday night. It was a very good game and very competitive, and if you saw both student bodies, you saw the excitement. It was standing room only, and it's the way high school football should be. And after the game, they did rush the field, and the bands went out, and they did their thing, and it was very exciting to see. So congratulations, Jeff. And thanks for having myself and Jeff Brandau here to give you a little presentation on concussion protocol. If you remember back a couple years ago, we did something very similar to this. But since then, some things have changed, so we've gone ahead and kind of added to this slides presentation. And I'll tell you, I've been around football for many years. I won't date myself, but I did start coaching in 1985 and coached varsity football for 30 years. And I've seen concussion protocol, the way it's changed, and it's for the better, and our district does a great job of that. I remember back in 85, a kid got bonked on the head. You took a little smelling salt, and Mr. Quisenberry can attest to this, put it under a kid's nose and say, get back in there. Whereas now we are very conscientious, and thank you for providing two full-time trainers. We have Brian Tuohy from San Luis and Katie Onrud from Morobe High School here tonight as well, who do a fantastic job and take care of our kids. So we went ahead and put together a little presentation for you. Let me see. Not working.
A little technical difficulty. We'll be right on that.
Okay.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry about that. So we went ahead and put together this presentation.
You have to stand in the magic spot to operate.
Oh, that's so funny.
Maybe you should stand there, Brian.
It's a finesse.
Okay, there we go. Thank you again. So what we've done is we put together the participation numbers. I won't go into it, but the important numbers are that out of our 764 students at Morobe High School, 463 participated in athletics last year. It's about 60%. We're hoping that number goes up. But another number is about 780 students play multiple sports, so it basically doubles those kids play two sports. The one thing you probably want to see is the concussion breakdown. This is put together by our athletic trainer, Katie Onrud, over the past 3 years. As you can see, where the concussions have occurred. And And I'll go ahead and turn it over to Mr. Brando, who will talk a little bit about San Luis.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Dr. Prater and School Board, for having us tonight. I think it was 2 years ago in this exact room we had this presentation, so it's deja vu all over again. As John said, a couple things I'd like to start with. One, Mr. Pinkerton, you were vital in this, and the School Board supported it. I wanted to thank you guys for being at the forefront of hiring two full-time athletic trainers. San Luis Sports Therapy, we've always had a contract with in the past, decided to opt out of it. Mr. Pinkerton and the Personnel Commission, you guys are ahead of the game. You guys did a great job. You gave them a 215-day contract. We couldn't be happier, and our students couldn't be luckier to have that. So I just want to thank you guys for that. The thing I want to say thank you is for the additional 14 stipends that you guys have given us. It's allowed us to offer more sports and different levels of sports. At San Luis High and Morro Bay High School this year, we'll be offering stunt cheer in the spring as a CIF sport. We'll also be offering girls wrestling in the winter, which is, again, two opportunities for our female student athletes to participate. At San Luis Obispo High School the last couple of years, and again this year, we will also offer additional soccer teams at the JV level. So all really, really good things, all really, really positive. For us at San Luis Obispo High School the last 2 years, we've had right below 1,000 student athletes. When you look at a school with 1,400 kids and you have almost 1,000 kids participating in athletics, that's pretty amazing. Like John said, we presented it wrong direction. It's not just you, John.
Thanks.
Our numbers are on that sheet if you guys want to look at it. Here's our concussion breakdown for the last 3 years, not including this year. So for 2014-15, 15-16, and 16-17, you will see, obviously, wide variety of sports. You have basketball, softball, water polo. There's actually cheer on there, swim and dive, and you also see football as well. One of the things that has changed, and we will touch on a little bit later during the presentation, is the restrictions and how football practices are run. John will touch on that a little bit later. But you will see that concussions happen in all sports. And Mr. O'Connor and myself are very intentional with the wording we use at our parent meetings, at our back-to-school nights, at our fall sports, winter sports, spring sport meetings. There's definitely an inherent risk in playing sports, and it's not just football, it's all sports. We have kids in swimming and water polo who've swam into the wall and got concussions. We've had golfers get concussions getting in and out of vans. We've had baseball players get injured. And these are all things that have literally happened the last few years. So while you do see football, I think a positive there, you'll see that our numbers have gone up for total number of student athletes. In terms of football at San Luis Obispo High School, the numbers are actually trending down the last couple of years, which is a positive thing for us. When we're talking about student safety, and we're going to walk you guys through all student safety-related athletics, we're not just going to talk concussions tonight. When we talk about student safety, the number one area that we're going to talk about first is coaches, because the coaches are kind of like the classroom teachers. They're the ones that are with the student athletes the most. So we obviously talked about having a full-time trainer, which is fabulous. Coaches. State law, Assembly Bill 2127, which is a concussion, requires that every 2 years, all paid coaches, again, I'll say that again, it's paid coaches, are required to go through concussion training. John and myself have worked on this for a number of years. We don't just do the paid coaches. We have all coaches, whether they're volunteer, walk-on, teacher, whatever terminology you want to use. If they're around our student athletes and a little kid calls them coach, they're a coach. So whether they're paid or volunteer, we do this annually. Again, state law is every 2 years. I tell my coaches, John tells his coaches, sorry, we're going to do it every year. So every year, when it comes to concussion and also cardiac awareness, because there's a student athlete in the state of California that actually dropped dead from that, we require our coaches and our volunteers and our walk-ons and our teacher coaches, everybody, to do it every year. We do this annually, so it's on the forefront of everyone's mind because safety is the most important. So again, we've worked together to go above and beyond what state law requires. I'll be honest, some of our coaches don't like doing it every year. But when you take something 2 years ago and you forget about it, it's not that great for us. So it's important that we do it every year. Not only that, but our coaches are also trained in CPR and first aid. Ms. Newland later will show you some other stuff they're trained in. They're also trained in bloodborne pathogen, mandatory reporting. They have to get H6. There's a whole litany of boxes they have to check in order to be around our student athletes. But without a doubt, fingerprints, concussion training, cardiac awareness, CPR, first aid, bloodborne pathogen, mandatory reporting, these are things that require everyone who's around our kids to do. Hello. Did I go too far? Nope. Okay, student athletes. All of our student athletes are required to fill out a physical packet. And this is really important, and this actually changed a little bit recently. Part of the physical packet is that a licensed medical doctor, not a nurse, not a nurse practitioner, not a chiropractor, not a dentist, but actually a medical doctor has to sign off and clear them. I'm going to give you guys some background. Both schools offer physical nights to our student athletes in the spring for next year. We did ours in May of last year at San Luis Obispo High School. We had quite a few kids who were part of spring football, or they're doing something else, or they ran there, and they actually had a high heart rate or high something like that, and the doctor didn't clear them. We have kids every year who medical doctors won't sign off on them, and they have to actually go see a specialist because maybe their heart rate's out of whack, maybe this is out of whack, maybe they fainted a year ago. This is very extensive, and our doctors and our local community volunteer at both of our high schools. They also volunteer at Los Osos Middle School in Laguna to come in and do these for free for the kids. But they definitely have to have a medical doctor sign off on their health. Part of that is also having a health history form, which they must fill out, and they must be thorough on. And if they don't fill that out, they will not be cleared as well. They also must provide a proof of insurance, something that we've pushed the last couple of years at San Luis Obispo High School. I know John has as well, is that we ask and we tell parents and community members that additional insurance can be purchased. We've had kids tear their knees up, and parents are in my office complaining because it costs $15,000 to $20,000 to have reconstructive knee surgery. We tell all of our parents at our parent nights, you can buy additional insurance for as little as $60. And that's something that we push as well. So that all goes into the pre-screening. This all has to be done before they even try out or they're part of one of our teams. Overall safety. I'm not going to read it, but basically the nutshell is that our athletic trainers are seen as the medical experts on our campus. They are in charge of the health and the well-being of our student-athletes. We do have AEDs that we've worked with the district on the last couple of years to get. Our athletic trainers carry one with them at all times. We also have one inside of the gymnasiums at both schools. And the athletic trainers, like I said, they are definitely responsible for the health and the well-being. They're there. Their contract says 215 days. They are there, honestly, probably more than that. They are always there. They travel with the football teams when they travel. All home events, sporting events, they are there, and they're required to be there. They're there for practices as well. So that's a huge, huge bonus for our kids.
Mr. Unger would like to interject.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question going back to the student athletes where you talked about additional insurance may be purchased. So I'm assuming that Medi-Cal, well, first of all, students must provide proof of insurance. I'm assuming Medi-Cal counts. Is that
correct?
Yes,
correct. Yes.
And do we have parents who would like to buy additional insurance who can't afford it? And if we do, are there ways that we can help those parents with those subsidies? Because, you know, if we have a poor parent, I mean, it could throw somebody into bankruptcy.
Absolutely. Personally, myself, I have not experienced that. We definitely make it, we announce it, that it's possible to buy extra insurance. Every year, I would say less than 20 parents do. We've never had a parent who couldn't afford it. If they could not afford it, we'd obviously help them with that. I don't speak on your behalf.
We have about three or four students every year that needs insurance, and we, as an athletic department, we pay for that, or out of school needy student funds. So there is that option for them.
Thank you.
Before you go on, that was my question as well, and I wrote down insurance fund. We provide free physicals, but do you make it clear to the students that if they desire, or to the parents, when speaking to the parent group, that if they desire insurance, additional insurance, and cannot afford it, that an accommodation can be made? Or do you wait for someone to come to you and say, geez, I really can't afford it?
A little bit of both, depending on the students. We know our students fairly well, and if they're needy, we reach out to them. If they're not, then usually we just kind of see where they're at as far as insurance goes and help them where needed.
And ditto at Slough?
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
Walter has a question.
Mr. Millar.
I was going back to stunt cheer because I noticed there was a low incident of concussions for cheerleading, but tell me about stunt cheer.
So, great question. I'm going to speak honestly and bluntly. Stunt cheer is going to be a spring sport. It's going to be treated just like all other CAF sports. So at San Luis Obispo High School in Morro Bay, we'll have tryouts, we'll have uniforms, we'll have pads, which are very expensive. Luckily, we already have them. Stunt cheer there is a risk involved with stunt cheer. They're dancing, they're doing all that stuff. Whether it's sideline cheer, which is considered fall sideline cheer, or stunt, it's actually called stunt. They don't want to confuse the two, but we call it stunt cheer, so you guys know what it is. There'll definitely be a risk. I mean, it's a sport where we got to spend money and we got to buy the pads and all that stuff. So,
can you just describe the types of things they would do in stunt cheer that differentiates it from fall cheer?
It's competitive. So basically, whether the format they prefer to have is three schools. They do it with two schools as well. They will compete against each other in routines. They will have like a scripted routine, and one team can ask the other team to perform it. Let's say Team A calls out Team B and says, hey, we want you to do performance number 12. They have to do performance number 12. They're judged on it or rated on it.
Do these performances involve students standing or building a thing about how high up do these pyramids and other kinds?
I'm not an expert on that, I'll be honest with you.
High enough to get a concussion?
High enough where we are definitely concerned, and we will make sure at both schools that we have the proper protocols and the proper pads and all that stuff, because, you know, same thing with sideline cheer. You got girls 10, 12 feet up in the air, it's definitely something that can be concerning. And we've had it. We've had girls in cheerleading get hurt in the past. Absolutely. They fall, they hit their head, all that stuff. That definitely happens. But that's something we're aware of in the spring. Any other questions before we go on? Okay. Injury protocol and parent communication. The big thing here on injury protocol and parent communication is that our athletic trainers are back here, Brian Tuohy and Katie Enneron at Morro Bay. They handle all the communication. I know John and I work with them, and they both do a great job. They're both veterans on this. They over-communicate. They make personal phone calls. They usually follow up with an email, and they do a magnificent job working with the parents, the student athletes, and the coaches, so there's never a miscommunication of, is a kid on, isn't eligible to play, is he cleared, is she cleared? They send out coaches' reports, which let the coaches know John has a sprained ankle, he can practice, but he can't play in games. Whenever there's a concussion, immediate contact is made. We prefer face-to-face. We also follow up with home phone calls and home emails as well. So that communication piece definitely comes from the athletic trainers. They do a magnificent job of it. They have the contact information for all the student athletes, and they do a great job communicating with the parents and with the student athletes and with the coaches, so there's no miscommunication.
Mr. Unger.
So one of the things that I know you'll touch upon later is the concussion protocol baselines.
Yes.
I don't know if you're prepared to talk about those now or if you'll talk about them later in the presentation, because I am curious what that looks like.
Yep.
And how that applies to later kind of a however you take the baseline and apply it to a student who may be injured.
Yeah, we can talk about it now. John will go over it later, but I'll talk about it now as well. No, it's fine. I mean,
I can wait.
No, it's fine. The concussion protocol, basically, the main thing we want to do is we want to get a baseline score on the majority of our student athletes. There are some sports that are considered high contact sports. Your water polos, your basketballs, your footballs, your cheers, those are considered high contact. There's other sports like tennis that aren't considered as high contact. The goal is always for us at both schools to get as many baseline tests as you can. Basically, they go on a computer and they take a test, and it spits out a number, how quickly they can answer questions and their cognitive response. It gives a general indication. It's not an IQ test. It's nothing like that. We have that in case, let's say John's a student athlete and he sustains a concussion, whether it's in cheer or football or water polo or basketball or whatever sport. We have that, so as the process of them returning to play, which is a state-mandated return-to-play protocol, which we'll go over in detail in a little bit, we have that baseline or that beginning number so we know where they're at. They have to be cleared by a medical doctor. That's part of the return-to-play protocol, but we definitely want that baseline number, and then once they've been cleared by a doctor, to be very similar, to be close. If they're not in the same range, we don't move forward with the return-to-play protocol.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Thank you. So again, parent communication done by our athletic trainers. Our athletic trainers have the full ability at both schools to pull student athletes, whether it's concussion, sprained ankle, hurt shoulder, whatever it is. Coaches don't argue with our athletic trainers. Parents don't argue. The athletic trainers have, I mean, they might, but the athletic trainers have the full authority to pull kids, and they do. Anytime, whether it's a concussion or other serious injury is suspected. Okay, football specific, and this will be my last slide, and I'll turn it back over to Mr. Andre. This is something that, to brag a little bit, I'm very proud of John and myself on this. We've kind of pushed the envelope with this. This came out of our presentation to you guys 2 years ago. We've pushed the envelope on this, and St. Louis Coastal Unified has been kind of recognized as the pioneer in this. In a normal football game, a freshman or a junior varsity football game, there'd be four officials. In a normal football game, varsity level, there'd be five officials. The past 2 or 3 years, John and I have worked extensively. We're in separate leagues, but we've worked to make sure all of our home games, we have 5 and 7. So JV games have an additional referee, 5, and varsity games, we have 2 additional referees, 7. The Friday night Morro Bay St. Louis game, we had 7 officials for the varsity game and 5 officials for the JV game. An extra set of eyes or 2 extra set of eyes when you have 22 kids running around goes a long way. There is a cost added, to be quite frank. Some of the other schools that we play don't like the fact that we do it. They feel that it slows the game down and there's more calls and blah, blah, blah. Student safety is our number one concern. So that's something we've done. Other schools and other districts have actually started to adopt this, and the Referees Association, this is the preferred method that they go with. So that's one thing we've done, football specific for safety. Another thing we've done is we record all of our games. Usually from 2 views, usually from the sideline view, like looking down on it, and also from the end zone view, looking at it this way. This past Saturday, we played Morro Bay High School. I was just talking to John about it. Saturday morning, my head football coach, Mr. Pat Johnston, came in and showed me a play that we deemed unsafe. Not saying anything bad about Morro Bay or anything like that, but there was a play that we deemed unsafe that we felt that there should have been a penalty called on, and we sent it to the head of CIF officials, and we sent it to the head of the football officials, and we sent it to the officials that were there that day. And I'm going to share it with John, and we use it as a learning tool. We record these games. We all know that officials, whatever sport it is, they make mistakes, but we definitely use this video evidence, especially in a sport like football, because this is football specific, and we do this in other sports, but really in football specific, to worry about the safety. So we definitely film every game, and any questionable calls or things we felt should have been called, we send it and we ask it to be reviewed, and that happens pretty much every week. And the other thing we do football specific, like I said earlier, all of our coaches, paid, volunteered, whatever term you want to use, anybody that works with our kids, they're above and beyond trained according to the state of California. Any questions for me before I turn it over to John? All right, Mr. Andre.
Thank you. One of the things I want to let you know, too, is Jeff and I are in constant contact with each other, so the two schools are very similar in everything that we do as far as our safety and even just clearing athletes and so forth. So if you have any questions on that. Okay.
It doesn't like it, John.
It does not.
Maybe Jeff could hold it for you. And
yeah.
Sorry, Brian. We're going to need you again.
Must be my magnetic personality that just keeps throwing that off.
That's what it is.
That's so funny.
All right, I'm going to get to talk about football-specific safety, as if you can see in the slide. One of the things I want to let you know is that the equipment that we purchase, if you were to watch Saturday's college football and then watch the pros on Sundays and even on Mondays and Thursdays now, you'd see the exact same equipment that the pros are using that we use at our high school level. So our kids are given the same equipment, and it's the same safety as at the highest level that you'll see. One of the things, too, is we also send our equipment in yearly, and it gets reconditioned. And if a helmet is defective or it's over its age of 10 years, they discard that, and we have to purchase new helmets. And, you know, we're about 12 helmets a year. I don't know about San Luis, but it's kind of a high turnover because, like I said, safety is number one. Now, one of the other things that CIF has done to really help with safety is that there are certain practice limits for football and the contact level. No longer are, like when I played, it was, you know, you did double days, sometimes triple days, and it was 2-3 hours of practice, and you hit and didn't get water. Well, now what it is, it's basically you're only allowed a double day every other day, and it's limited contact. Times that you're also not in full gear, we call it thud, where everything's kind of form-fitting. Other things that we do is not a lot of live tackling, because the majority of your injuries injuries used to occur during practices. Now we're seeing that number reduced greatly because of the fact that we've not only reduced the contact level, but also the fact that we've instituted this heads-up football tackling that the kids use, where years ago you'd teach, put your head across and into the football. Well, now you don't even use the word head. It's basically you're wrapping up with your arms, kind of like a rugby tackle. And so it's as you can see, it's not just the heads, it's other injuries that you don't see, shoulders or so forth in football, because it's a style of tackling that even Pete Carroll's using at the pro level. At our games, it's safety is number one. If you come to a Morro Bay High School game, we have our athletic trainer, Katie Honorood, who's there. We have a physical therapist, Michael Williams, who's there. And then we also have our team doctor, Dr. Fowl, who is there. And I know San Luis also has their team doctor at their games as well. So we have instant medical care right there on the spot. And when a kid gets dinged up, even if there's... You know, Katie's constantly watching the mechanics of the play. She sees a kid go down and hit his head. She will say, hey, let's pull that kid off. Or a coach will, you know, they've been trained, let's get that kid off. And then they come and they go to Katie. And then they with the doctor there and so forth, they can evaluate and see what level of concussion, if any, has occurred. We don't have an ambulance present at our home games, just because if you look across the street, we have the ambulance company with a response time of about 3 minutes. San Luis usually has an ambulance close. But we do have, a lot of times we'll have firefighters there. They come to watch the game, I think, most of the time. But there's a, like I said, we're probably overkill on the safety, but we just feel that it makes us feel safe. I talked about the safe tackling techniques. The one of the things that you need to understand, it's more about hands and grabbing, more so than leading with your head. And it's something that our coaches do on a daily basis. We call them EDDs, everyday drills, where they go through this form of tackling. Now, the biggest thing with this concussion protocol that we like to talk about is the major priority for us is that safety is number one, and we take it out of the coach's hands. Like Jeff had said, that it's our trainers. They have the full authority to remove a kid or put a kid in a game, and we take the coach element out of it, where, you know, you get a coach who's passionate about, let's get that kid back in there, where we don't have to worry about that anymore, because, like I said, with our athletic trainers, they do a great job of making sure that they've seen the mechanics of the injury, and as well as checking the kid out, and if they feel that they're fine, they'll put him back in. If not, they hold him out. And I would venture to say, just from what I've seen, whether you saw those numbers, they err on the side of caution. And lastly, I just want to show you the steps. Jeff had talked about the preseason baseline and education. There is also something we send home in our physical packet that the parents have to read on concussion, and both the child and the parent have to sign off so they can see the signs of concussion. Because sometimes a child will play in a game and then get home and then maybe say, hey, I've got a little headache, and the mom has read, or dad has read through that, and then they can refer them back to us, and we have them see Katie, and we do go through the concussion protocol. Do you have a question?
Hey, John, do we have that in Spanish as well?
We do, absolutely. We have the baselining. The athletic trainers, like Jeff said, they take everybody from every sport, and before the season, they sit them down, they go into the computer lab, and they go through this test, so every kid is baselined, even if in the non-contact sports. And then, like I said, the step two is if the concussion is suspected, they've seen the mechanics, then if they've been diagnosed by Katie, like, hey, we're going to just make sure that we're going to err on the side of caution that you may have a concussion, it's suspected, then they are sent to a doctor. And then immediately after concussion starts, that's when they have a protocol for a timeline that it begins at that time. Once they're referred to the doctor makes the diagnosis. And then with step four, if diagnosed with a concussion, the athletic trainer goes through a series of processes that tries to get the athlete back in an amount of time that is relative to there's the concussion that's sustained. Step five is that they've start and finish that graduation. As you can see, day one is they get them on a bike and they see how they do. If they get headaches, then the protocol starts all over again. And until the headaches stop, then they then they will start this process. So you have day one is biking, then they run for 20 minutes, then they do an agility for 45 minutes, and then they do them practice but with no contact. So what that means with football is they basically just kind of run out but stay out of all contact, and they just want to see how they do within the contents of that practice. And then they do limited contact, which is probably like our little thud. They get in there and they kind of run around and make a little contact to see how they're doing. And then the last one is no restriction. And if they've done all of those and shown no signs of concussion, then at that point, they go back to the doctor and they get full clearance. We don't meet with the administration. I know San Luis does. That's something that we're venturing in to see if maybe we want all of our kids to come in and meet with our administration. But that's a step that we haven't instituted yet, but we do steps 1 through 6. So that's basically, yes.
I do have a question. Mr. Brandel or Mr. Andre, so are you saying there is no head-to-head contact, that you don't allow it, but it sometimes happens?
Yeah, in our practices, we allow no head-to-head contact. And in games, if there is head-to-head contact, like if a kid blatantly goes in with his head, then that's a spearing call, and it's a penalty, so it's obviously discouraged by everybody. You are going to have your incidental contacts where two kids will hit head-to-head, but we see the majority of the injuries is not the head-to-head collisions, it's the head hitting the ground is where I see a lot of them, remembering as a football coach.
Do we have helmets with sensors in them too?
No, and they found that in the study that I looked at, that the sensors weren't inducive to whether a kid got a concussion, because sometimes the impact does not affect the head itself, and it'll register higher. And other times, a kid will really get walloped, and they'll come off the field dizzy, and it'll register that it wasn't very high. So it's not a real conclusive type of thing with the sensor. So most teams, even at the pro and college level, actually, I don't know of any teams that are using those.
Are we using, or are other schools using, the sheaths with the Wonder, the memory foam on the outside to prevent other people from being injured?
No, we haven't done that because, like I said, in practices, we're not using head-to-head contact. It's more, when our tackling drills, it's more form tackling. And then when we do our, full contact, it's more of like a thud where a kid will come up and just wrap a kid. Rarely is it to the ground in practice.
But in games.
In games it is, yeah, but they don't wear the padded thing in the games.
No one does.
Yeah.
Mr. Buckman?
I just want to take the opportunity while you're both here. Last year I attended an event at San Luis High School where we had the Hispanic. We stood next to each other most of the time. We had a great thing for the Hispanic students and their families. And one of the things I noticed was there was a lot of outreach going on by the athletic, but also by the staff. And is that adding to, is that increasing the numbers for the players? Because my concern is that if the Hispanic students are not comfortable, and if they feel like they don't have enough money and they don't know about the help aid that they can get, the outreach seemed to be really important. So.
Well, I know Mr. Jones, who is our outreach with our Hispanic students, talks a lot about athletics. We haven't had any formal meetings about that, but like I said, we have a pretty good sense. We're a smaller school. Our coaches are very, very good in knowing their athletes, especially at football. We have on-campus coaches, and we do a lot of outreach to their parents that are in individual programs. We have expectation meetings at the beginning of the year where the athletes come in and their parents come in, and we talk to them about our expectations and talk to them, like Jeff had talked about, insurance and anything that has to do with the sport specific. And with football, we talk about we go over the physical form with them and talk about concussions and if they suspect that, to go ahead and contact us.
So, thank you. That's important for me. The other thing that I think I noticed was the counselors were working fairly close with the athletic staff and saying, this student's having trouble connecting with school, and we think sports would be good for them. And is that still ongoing, or is it something that's...
Well, I'll let Jeff field this one for San Luis, and then I can talk about it afterwards.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Great question, Mr. Buckman. Like I said earlier, we've really put an emphasis the last couple of years, and you guys are all in education. You know that the more involved kids are, the higher rate for them to succeed. I've worked closely with some of our assistant principals, Mr. Frost and Mr. Black, and the ELA committee. We've had the event that you were at. We had last year's physical translated all into Spanish, and we really pushed that. We worked with Mr. Scaldi at Laguna. We want to get kids involved. That's the bottom line. We are very proud at our school. I know John as well. We want to get as many kids involved as we can. Doesn't matter their background, doesn't matter their ethnicity, doesn't matter how much money they have. It's our responsibility to provide that for them. So we definitely push that. We try to get kids involved, whether it's football or a different sport. But yeah, the push to get kids cleared, the biggest hurdle, honestly, for both schools is to get kids to get their physical, because if they don't come to the physical night, then they're stuck with, well, it costs $75, or, you know, I can't go now. That becomes the issue. So the biggest thing that we work on is that outreach in the spring and that communication. But to be quite frank, we had our team doctor this year, Dr. Weiss, was giving kids physicals in August who wanted to play football but didn't get one last year, and it was free, and he brought it in, and we do that as well. Our team doctors will come in and work with the kids, and that's really important. We never want to deny anybody an opportunity, but we want to make it available to everyone, and we do that by trying to communicate and over-communicate and translate things into Spanish, and let them know the expectations and let them know the timing of everything. That's probably the other big thing that we struggle with. You have kids coming in from middle school. The seasons don't always line up from middle school to high school. There's two or three sports. Now there's 23 sports. So those are some of the things we struggle with, and that's white students, Hispanic students, rich students, poor students, and that's our job to communicate that, and we do our best to do that.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Hi. I have a couple of quick questions. One is going back very briefly to the AEDs. I'm assuming those are need to be tested. Who tests those and make sure that they're operating properly?
So we actually monthly check them.
Okay.
To make sure that the little green light is going, type of thing. And then there's our AED, as a school district, we actually have to sign up for a whole company and process. So each month we get a drill. All the custodians go by. They check all the AEDs, make sure that they're functioning. That gets sent to Mandy. So it's a monthly check-in. Okay. And then every 2 years we have to change out the batteries. It's an ongoing process with the AED companies.
Thank you. And secondly, with regard to football, I'm curious about some of the equipment and the uniforms. So I'm assuming, which could be a big mistake, that the pads and the helmets, are those supplied by the school? Kids aren't saying, oh, I can...
Everything is provided. We have a lot of kids who will end up wanting to buy their own mouthpieces. We do provide those as well. But everything, all safety equipment, all equipment for all sports that's required, we provide.
And then how does the cost of that sort out?
In terms of for us as an athletic department?
Well,
or
for the are those costs passed on to the students?
No.
Is that
There's no cost passed on to the student.
So not for uniforms?
Nope.
Not in any of our sports.
Not in any of our sports.
So that is a very good change, because that hasn't been the case, always been the case. So, okay, so the students are not responsible for paying anything.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Can I piggyback on that?
Sure.
Yes, Mrs. Roger?
To piggyback on that, for years I heard complaints that cheerleading was underfunded and had to really raise money to get their uniforms. Now that cheerleading is an acknowledged sport in both of its capacities, the two different types of cheerleading, does that mean now that cheerleaders are also receiving uniforms free of charge?
Yes. A couple of years ago, we spent, Leslie probably knows the number off the top of his head, we spent a large amount of money to buy our cheerleaders' uniforms. We provide cheerleaders with their uniforms. It's just like basketball, just like football. They check them in, they check them out. The thing that we struggle with sometimes at San Luis Obispo High School is kids want to just keep stuff. It's like, no, this is yours. It's kind of like a textbook. We're going to check it out, and we're going to get it back, because when I buy a set of uniforms, it's $4,000 or $5,000, and if they all walk out the door at the end of the year, I got to spend another $4,000 or $5,000, and that wouldn't be very good business. So we check stuff in. We check stuff back. I can tell you in the 6 years I've been at San Luis High School, we've spent above and beyond for cheerleading. The cheer mats that we have are very, very expensive. They'll be the same ones that we use for stunt. And the cheerleading uniforms that we bought, was it 2 years ago, Leslie? We bought cheerleading uniforms 2 years ago that was $5,000, $6,000, $7,000. It was very, very expensive. So we are very cognizant of that. John and I both are. A lot of the athletic director workshops that we go to and the material that we read to continue to develop professionally. The hot topic is you can't charge kids money. It has to be optional, and that's something we're very aware of. Now, with that being said, there are optional things, optional spirit packs. If kids want to buy two extra sweatshirts, which are not required, they're not game uniforms, they're not required, but if they want to buy them and grandma and grandpa want to buy one, they're allowed to do that. That's going above and beyond. In terms of uniforms, safety equipment, stuff like that, we provide that.
All the basics are provided.
Yep, all the game uniforms. And speaking on earlier what John said, the helmets is a big one. Every year, it's between 10 and 20 helmets. They come take all of our shoulder pads, all of our helmets. They box them up. They ship them out. They test them. When helmets come back bad, we buy new ones. Just this year, we had two very large kids at San Luis Obispo High School, thank God, that we had to buy double extra large helmets. I've never even heard of that before. But every year, helmets and shoulder pads are checked by an outside company, and they're just like the pros, just like college, to make sure that they're safe. And if they're at all questionable, they get tossed, and we buy new ones. And we provide that.
And that would be our expectation. So I'm glad that you do that.
Yep.
And the funding source for the uniforms, the pads, the helmets, all of the accoutrement of sports, is that black and gold for you and blue and white for you, Mr. Andre, or is that district
Mine
provided?
Is the CIT wrestling term.
Okay.
We do fundraisers.
That's actually a great question. We do fundraisers, and to speak frankly and honestly, our five home football games are five of our biggest fundraisers for us as an athletic department. John, you said the gate Friday night was, what, $8,000? Is that about right? So Friday night, when they hosted us in football and we had standing room only, it was an $8,000 gate. For some of our bigger games, we'll get 8 to 10. Now, if it's an out-of-town team or whatever, you might get 4 or 5. So your five home football games are big. We also charge admission to our home sporting events where we have officials, and I know that John does the same thing. Our Tiger Athletic Booster Club raises a large amount of money, and I know John has a booster club as well. So those are the funding sources for how we pay for things.
Mr. Millar.
Thank you.
This question may be for administration and you guys both. So a lot of the things you just described are required through Title IX.
Right.
For boys and girls sports. Are we currently compliant with Title IX and no longer under a consent decree regarding girls volleyball, I think it was?
So the answer to that is yes. Kristen Newland can probably fill you in, but Kristen each year publishes and goes through the whole Title IX, number of students in each sport, number of coaches, number of sports, all those types of things. So CIF actually mandates it, Ed Code mandates it now each year that you kind of put that out.
Yeah, to add to that, it's on both of our websites as well. It's required to be on our athletics websites on both of ours. And every year we do a Title IX check, and both schools are in compliance.
Gentlemen, I have a tremendous amount of respect for both of you and the programs that you put on. They're important for community building and spirit building. And I also have concerns. And I know that you're aware of the brain studies that the NFL did of 111 professional football players and found that 110 of them had degenerative brain disease. So that's a concern. And I'm sure you're aware of, I know that you're aware of Ed Cunningham, the announcer for ESPN of football games, just walking away from a large contract saying, I can't do this anymore. Do you ever feel that we should be contemplating what to do about this in our growing high school boys' brains?
Well, as somebody who's coached for 30 years at the high school varsity level, you know, there's always concern and inherent risk with any sport that you play. Like Jeff had brought up, my son was a swimmer. He got a concussion on a backstroke running into the wall. You know, there's a larger number of football players. That's why when you saw those graphs that maybe you saw, whoa, football stood out. But, yeah, in the football program there's 100 kids, where with basketball there's 15, with soccer there's 20. So it's a relative to as many kids are playing. So to answer your question, you know, I question about everything. I question about it when my son goes outside to ride his bicycle or drives his car. It's just one of those things that, you know, it's the pros. I mean, the what these kids get out of it being part of a team, learning to work as a group, to critically think about problem solving. You know, it's an outstanding sport. Football is, and as well as all of them are. And my big thing is, and Jeff, we were talking about this before, is that in any sport that you play, you can get a concussion. And when you talk about pros, that's different. Okay, you're talking about the elite athletes. We're talking about gentlemen that weigh 300 pounds and run 4.640s and run into each other, where still at the high school level, you know, you haven't seen any studies about that with the high school. And until I see something like that, you know, they're not having those types of collisions. It's like, you know, Kyle and I were talking about it today. If our kids are still Volkswagens kind of bumping into each other, whereas if they're, when they get to the pros, they're semi-trucks. And that's a difference. And that's why when they take that study, that it's going to be far different than at the high school level.
Isn't the NFL recommending things like no kickoff? Like that's where most of the injuries happen, during kickoffs.
Yeah, and they've done some things too as well. You know, I'm not an expert, but I follow football, and they don't tackle as much in practice, and they don't hit as much, and you know, we've become a lot more aware of concussions. So I think just that, with the safety that we're going through, my son played football, and his mother was a little shaken, but being somebody who's been around for 30 years, I know if he has proper technique and he's got good coaches, which we all do, that he's going to be just fine.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, for your concern.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sorry, Mr. Millar.
I noticed we have 9.04 certification of temporary athletic coaches, and I'm wondering if we should handle that now, since we may want to ask some of the folks who are here for this last item some questions about that.
9.02 is the next
perfect
item.
Timing. We actually moved it around, so I could have these two gentlemen here. So as you know, we started middle school athletics, and then when we started middle school athletics, that really brought me into this world, and I turned to these two gentlemen because it's very clear that they are absolutely solid with their systems and their procedures that they're using. And so I really asked John to help Loams and Jeff to help Laguna in showing them all of the protocols and processes that they were using. And so in August, the four schools got together, and it was clear that I really wasn't the most knowledgeable in the room. It was these two. And so they shared all the materials that they had. But in order to prepare for that meeting, Jeff had asked me if I would put together a checklist of required trainings that all schools should have. And so it was through that I ended up doing a lot of research, and I ended up reading the Lozano Smith. They have a coaching manual that's excellent, that's been out for quite a while, and they send updates all the time. And I read that, and I realized there was one item that we hadn't been doing that we should be doing. And so that's why we're here tonight, is that this is on the action, an action item on the agenda, but in the future you'll see it on the consent agenda, because it needs to be done 30 days after the beginning of each season to be able to hire, to certify. So we are certifying to you. Basically, the athletic directors, each one of the schools, are certifying to me, and I bring this item to you, that they have been through the training. And the people that are listed in the letters are the paid coaches. We do have other volunteers, but they are not listed there. Those are the people that we have record of in the personnel office that are being paid. So they're varsity coaches, JV coaches, assistant coaches, and they're all receiving some kind of a stipend from us. So this is what the training looks like, and I had these gentlemen look over it today to make sure that, yes, we were all on the right page together. And so within 30 days of them being selected, they have to go through these trainings. So the clearances they have are fingerprinting, and then tuberculosis screening, which is every 4 years, and then H6 from the DMV, which certifies their driving record. We place them on the pull notice program, so if there is a driving issue, then we would know about it. But those are only for coaches that will be driving. Then once they're hired, then they have to go through a training, and then Jeff and John, and now Scott Scaldi and Carl Bloom, work with the coaches to go through these trainings. So the fundamentals of coaching is quite extensive. I looked it up today, it was like 32 sections. So it would take several hours at least to go through this. And in talking to Jeff, they used to hire a trainer to come do this, but now they use the NFHS course, which is the National Federation of High Schools. Anyway, that's for new coaches. Once it's done once, you don't have to redo that by law. And then CPR and first aid is done every 2 years. The mandated child abuse reporter requirement 2 years ago, they changed that to be annual for all employees that are going to be around children.
And so all of our employees do that. Bloodborne pathogens annually because they are exposed to blood through accidents and injuries. And then the concussions in sports, which you heard earlier, and the sudden cardiac arrest. So these are the trainings that we go through. So the board item that's on the agenda says basically you're going to be receiving this 3 times a year, right before each season, fall, winter, and spring. And then by April 1st, you as a board have to certify to the State Board of Education that all of our coaches have gone through this. And so there will be another board item that comes back to you before. It'll be in a March board meeting to certify that you're certifying to the State Board that, yes, all of your coaches have been through this. Any questions?
Yes, I do.
Yes, Mr. Buckland.
Thanks. So I think you're being incredibly modest about this. I actually went and took a look at the code of regulations in the section, and I mean, I was absolutely blown away. I mean, one of the things is there has to be a year of college level preparation for care of the athletes. So I can't believe that all of our assistant coaches. I just was blown, and there had to be 20 things in the code, mm-hmm. and just pretty.
And that's really kudos to these two. Yeah. And then they have now passed that knowledge off to the middle schools, so we know that it's being done at the middle school level as well. But it's really, I have to say, it's not me. It's really these two.
Yeah, it was impressive. I'd just like to take the opportunity. You mentioned the volunteers, but, you know, we have a lot of volunteers. I know some of them, and I just wanted to say thank you. And I wish I had their names, and maybe we could publish those someday. But I'm not sure. You guys probably couldn't do it without them, is my guess. But and we've got some graduates from some of our high schools, from both of the high schools that are coming back working with you guys. So I just want to send a thanks out to the volunteers as well.
And Mrs. Roger.
Okay, yes, thank you. I just wanted to clarify for myself that Mr. Andre and Mr. Brandow expressed to us that everyone is fully trained, including walk-ons and volunteers. And Kristen, when you were talking about paid employees, I'm wondering, at the middle school level, does it also include walk-ons and volunteers that receive this training?
I do not know that. Okay. Until this year, they hadn't been going through all of this training, and so this year we have now assured that they are. So, but those would be the paid, because the law requires the paid
volunteers. Could you inquire and let us know in a Friday update? Okay,
yep.
Thank you.
Mrs. Newland, you mentioned advanced agenda. Are we taking an action on this as well as on the advanced agenda?
Yes,
okay.
We are.
So,
I'll move approval of certification for temporary athletic coaches for the 2017-2018 fall sports season.
I'm sorry, ladies. I just did not get a chance to go to the public. Just one second. Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this item? Seeing no one. Thank you, Ms. Roger. We have a motion.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Mrs. Roger and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. 7-0. That passes. Thank you very
much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we're moving on to item number 9.03. This is presented by Mrs. McGrath and Mrs. Shields. The SBAC results. Okay, I'll wrestle
you
with
really
the clicker.
You know how to clear a room.
So this evening, Mrs. Shields and I will be sharing the results from our statewide mandated assessment. San Luis Coastal Unified School District students in grades 3 through 8 and 11 took the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium, which we refer to as SBAC, in the spring of 2017. So sharing these results and the extensive analysis that happens does address 4 out of our 5 focus areas. So, as you recalled, this is a drastically different test from the CST from the past. This is a rigorous assessment that checks for a range of skills and knowledge in both English language arts and mathematics. The SBAC assessment is part of the larger umbrella of that we call CASP test. These assessments are aligned to state standards, and students complete these assessments on devices. Keep in mind that they're also computer adaptive, so as the test will continue to adjust as students are responding.
There are four different levels of achievement. So student scores can be reported as met, nearly met, met, or exceeded the standard. In this evening's presentation, we will focus on the top two categories, the percent of students that have met or have exceeded the standard, as this is our goal for student achievement. You'll also notice that this is one of the first data presentations in which we're beginning to show our six consistent data points for our student groups. You will notice that we're analyzing results for all students, for non-socioeconomically disadvantaged students, for socioeconomically disadvantaged students, English language learners, reclassified fluent English proficient students, and students with disabilities. So now I will hand it over to Mrs. Shields, and she'll begin to explain English language arts results.
Hello, Mrs. Shields.
Okay, well, we'll begin with our English language arts, and you can see a three-year trend. This is showing our district as a whole, up from 59% to 67%. If I can do my addition, that would be a, help me out here, folks, 8%. I can't add and present at the same time. So a pretty hefty 8% over 2 years. So this is just the overview of all. After we look at that, we're going to go dig a little deeper into specific student groups. Our three-year trend for mathematics is an impressive 11% growth from 50 to 61%. Now we're going to dig a little deeper and look at our English language arts and mathematics performance by student group. And we'll begin with English language arts, which I'll refer to as ELA. This very first graph that you see shows the results for all students on the left, as well as each of our LCAP student groups. As you can see, the results indicate some significant discrepancies between our student groups. And in order to better understand these results, I'm going to dig a little bit deeper and show you three-year trends as well. I'm also going to share the results so you can see how one student group compares to another. We're going to start by looking at our non-SCD and our SCD data, or our non-socioeconomically disadvantaged student group versus our socioeconomically disadvantaged student group. Here you see the results for 1 year, our past spring 2017, showing a 35 percentage point difference between the 44 and 79% meeting or exceeding standards. But let's look at that over the past 3 years. These two graphs show a three-year growth comparison for our non-SCD on the left and our SCD student groups on the right. Both groups gained 6 percentage points over 3 years, which is movement in the right direction. While both groups of students are demonstrating growth over time, in order to shrink the achievement gap, we're going to need to realize an acceleration of progress by our SCD student group on a yearly basis. The next two graphs show a three-year growth trend for our English learners on the left-hand side and our reclassified fluent English proficient students on the right-hand side. While we would not expect a high percentage of students learning English to have met or exceeded ELA standards, the results indicate a promising 10 percentage point gain for our reclassified fluent English students. The most recent results for our RFEP group shows that 65% meeting or exceeding standards, which is within 2 percentage points of our overall district performance in English language arts. The Students with Disability, or SWD, group shows a 7 percentage point gain in English language arts over 3 years. And it's important for the board to notice that this group represents any student with an individual education plan, or IEP, who is academically able to access the SBAC. The continuum of students with IEPs who take the SBAC range from speech and language only students to students enrolled in a special day class placement, all of whom would qualify for accommodations during testing. I would say that we can expect to see continued growth in this student group as we continue to develop systems to improve access to our rigorous mainstream classrooms for all students with IEPs.
Are our parents of our students with disabilities, do they still have the option to opt out of the test for their students?
Actually, all students' parents do.
So do we find that many students with disabilities are opted out?
We have a very overall low percentage. I think Mrs. Frost might have a little bit more specific for student with IEPs.
We do have a very low percentage of our students with disabilities whose parents opt them out. In the cases where we do, it's often our more intensive cases where we won't have the children taking the exam.
Thank you.
And Mr.
I have a question as well. Amy, these test results were delayed, I don't know, a month, 2 months?
The public release has been delayed, yes.
Okay, so my concern is that would we normally get these results before we go into the LCAP, writing the LCAP goals?
No.
Okay, so that sort of doesn't make sense to me because what we're seeing now is the gaps and how large they are. And so I'm just, we've already committed our funding then for the LCAP spending, and we're seeing that. So is there some way that the district can sort of be nimble and redirect if we need to? I mean, later on you talk about
I'm going to address that very directly at the end of my report.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Thanks.
I'm going to move on to mathematics and look a little bit deeper. Here you see our student group performance. And this also indicates some specific significant discrepancies. Although overall our district score is quite positive, our socioeconomically disadvantaged students groups perform significantly lower than the students from the non-socioeconomically disadvantaged group, with a 34 percentage point difference, as did our EL and SWD group. If we look a little bit deeper, I again have the three-year growth comparisons for you in mathematics, the left side being the non-SED, the right side being the SED group. The non-SED group gained 10 percentage points, while the SCD group gained 13. The rate of acceleration for our socioeconomically disadvantaged students in mathematics is a positive step towards closing the achievement gap for our SCD student groups. However, what we know is accelerated academic progress needs to continue on a yearly basis. I'm giving you the summary of 3 years. We need to see that acceleration every year. Addressing the learning barriers of students living in low-income households must continue to be a top priority if we are to close or even shrink the achievement gap. The next two graphs show a three-year growth trend in mathematics for our English learners and reclassified students. Again, English learners on the left, reclassified English learners on the right. While we see a significant growth of 12 percentage points for our English learners, performance is significantly below district-wide results. It is important to acknowledge that even though this is a math test, the SBAC math assessment requires students to be familiar with extensive mathematical academic vocabulary and to be able to read and understand questions that require a thorough understanding of precise language. The RFEP results show a promising 18 percentage point gain over 3 years. The most recent results for our RFEP students that I showed you earlier show that the 53% of students that are meeting or exceeding standards is now within 8 percentage points of the district-wide result. And finally, in mathematics, the students with disabilities group shows a 5 percentage point gain in mathematics over 3 years. Similar to ELA, we should expect to see continued growth from this student group as we develop capacity in providing rigorous learning environments for our students with IEPs. In the beginning of a conclusion, our goal and, of course, our challenge is to create optimal learning environments in each of our classrooms that create emotionally, intellectually, and physically safe places for students to learn, that provide equitable, culturally responsive, and rigorous curriculum and instruction, and meet the needs of all the diverse learners in each of our classrooms. The board's number one priority for 2017-18, so actually, Mr. Buckman, I think you got it right back last spring, is to emphasize the LCAP focus areas.
All five of our LCAP goals, not just four, but all five of them, are focused directly on student achievement. The LCAP you approve puts in place a number of systems and supports to help all students achieve. I think it's also important to mention that underneath our district LCAP actions, there's ongoing work with achievement results that is being led by our principals with our teachers, critically analyzing data and putting supports and resources in place down to the classroom floors. As you know, the results have not yet been officially released by the CDE. We received our second preview this afternoon at about 3 o'clock. When this happens, I would love to return and publicly share with the board some data on our results compared to surrounding and similar districts. With that, Mrs. McGrath and I would welcome your questions.
Thank you. Mr. Buckman.
Yeah, so, Amy, this was great, and I really appreciate it being broken down within the subgroups that are required. So my concern, again, goes back to not having this data prior to us doing the LCAP. And we can't change how the state gives us the data, but it doesn't make sense to me. I help me understand, in the LCAP, we had specific percentage goals that we had set. And are those still, in your mind, is that where we should be at those percent increases, or is there something that we should have done different in the LCAP now that we have these results?
Well, I would answer that with, we don't have the final SBAC results, but SBAC is not everything. It's a big standard, but what we do have are common assessments in reading, in writing, in mathematics, kindergarten, all the way through high school, that give us some pretty good clues how our students are doing, all of our students, all of our student groups, not just at the end of the year, but along the way. And we look at those results, we study those results, schools use those results to tweak instruction, tweak support at the school. Cabinet discusses that as well, because often or sometimes we have to go to Ryan and say we need some extra support here to help this school out.
Thank you.
Mr. Unger.
So yeah, I was actually going to ask sort of, I'm thinking the common assessments, the district common assessments that we're that you present to us three times a year, I believe it is. It seems to me that they, although not a perfect alignment with the SBAC, that they tell a story that is with data that is more readily available to teachers and school sites to help hopefully drive instruction and to give them information. I think it's unfortunate that the state promised that they would have, I don't know what you call it, you know, SBAC lights that would give that kind of immediate feedback to the school sites has not been forthcoming and has not been very accurate. I think that the state is making an effort to remediate that, but we haven't seen that yet.
Can I just respond to that?
Yeah, please.
We just heard last week that new assessments, the interims that we had available that are SBAC-like, as you said, they were available last year, but they did not give us much actionable data or information that would support teachers in the classroom. They are getting it right, we think, where teachers can give an interim as many times during the year as they please. They're going to get individual student results back from that they can take action on in the classroom. So we're hopeful. They're telling us it's going to be in place.
That's great. I really appreciate the focus on student achievement and closing the achievement gap that I think we all, as a school district, have made as a commitment to our community and to our students. Although looking at the scores, I think can be not discouraging exactly, but tells the story that we have a lot of work to do if we're going to do the right thing for all of our students. we have not swept this under the rug. I think, how many years have we been talking about this, Dr. Prater? About 5 years? So I think we're
since
about...
Since 2011.
So 6 years we've been talking about this. We've known this. I think to our district's credit, we're not sweeping this under the rug, and we're continuing to make this the priority for our district. I think the data that we got today just continues to reinforce that need, that we need to continue to put our resources toward our students most in need, and to continue to look at this through the focus and the lens of equity.
Mrs. Sheffer.
I just wanted to briefly comment that it's my understanding from speaking with teachers that as we go through the year with assessments, that there is, and you touched on it briefly, but I think I just want to strengthen it a little bit, Mrs. Shields, that we do respond and we do try to be nimble and agile throughout the year, that, oh, if it looks as though a particular cohort or even a class at one site is results are indicating some challenges in a particular area, that we do respond as quickly as necessary with either funding or support or both or different ways of looking at things. And that's one of the things we've, I think we've become more rapidly responsive as a result of having principals in the room and teachers, the assessments that do occur throughout the year, that this is, the SBAC is not the end all and be all. It is the one that shows up as state results when comparing district to district. But I think our district is fortunate that with some of the systems we've been trying to put in place to be able to have a more rapid response where necessary based on things that we're observing throughout the year.
I certainly agree with that. I would just add to that, I think I may have been a little bit dismissive about the SBAC itself. The SBAC is a summative assessment that we get at the beginning of the following year. But with that, the SBAC is a really rigorous test that asks our students to perform high-level tasks. And this is where we're going in our district. This is where we're going in education. So it's the right end assessment. Yeah, it would be great if we could get it a little sooner. But I think the actionable items that we get are the things that happen throughout the year.
And for me, one of the interesting things with the SBAC is that it's adaptive. So the student, the way they answer the first question affects maybe where the second question goes. And maybe you can tell me, I'm not sure whether the common assessments that we're doing in the classroom have that capability. So for me, this is a very interesting test.
Mr. Unger?
I think one of the other impressive things that we're doing is what's going on in our classrooms every single day. And the teaching that our staffs are doing, the work we're doing in mathematics, the work we're doing with reading, the work we're doing with writing, I think we're seeing... And I think our scores ultimately will show that our teachers are doing the hard work to help our students achieve. And I think kudos go to the district administration, but clearly to the teachers who are in the classroom every single day working really hard with kids.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this item?
Yes, please come to the microphone.
Thank you very much, ladies.
Hello again. I just have a question about the students who were in the two categories that were, the not meeting the standards. I'm curious if those are also improving at the same rate that the students who are meeting the standards are improving, and why you think they are or are not, and why, to me, those are the students that I feel like if those students aren't meeting the standards, I want to look at that student body also and know more about them, but I think this was extremely helpful for someone who's new to the to the meetings and wants to understand more, so thank you.
Thank you. Oh, you want to answer that? Thank you.
I think it's important to understand that at a board meeting, we give a very global overall perspective. The really detailed, down to a student name, looking at annual growth, what's happening and successful and not successful per student is the excellent work that happens at the sites. So teachers and students hone in very specifically on the students that have not met and that have nearly met the standard and devise specific plans to address the needs of those students. And yes, we look at students that are moving from one area to the next and the annual progress that is happening with those students. Today is just an overall perspective where we looked at students that are meeting or exceeding the standard.
Thank you for explaining that, Mrs. McGrath.
Madam Chair.
And Mrs. Shields, did you want to add something as well?
Madam Chair.
No, okay.
Jim.
Oh, sorry, Jim. Mr. Quisenberry.
It's been on for a while. It's okay. As we look at these aspects, results, are we or can we at this point determine the students, whether the students that have been through our pre-K and our TK, whether that's having an impact on their scores?
They haven't taken the SBAC yet, so not quite.
So it's about, what, we're 3 years in yet?
Yep, I think we are. I think they'll be taking the SBAC this spring.
And we're looking at that.
Okay, we will be.
Thank you.
Good question. Seeing no one else, thank you very much. Oh, we have someone else from the audience. Mrs. Neuhauser.
My name is Judy Neuhauser. I'm from Los Osos. I almost missed out on my opportunity to really congratulate staff. Full disaggregation of the data is outstanding. The graphs showing 0 to 100%, outstanding. So all of those give you a really clear picture of what's going on. There's something that struck me from looking at these graphs. If you look at the pattern on the right, the 2015, 2016, 2017, there's been a steady... On all the graphs, it's shown that same pattern, a large jump from 2015 to 2016. And then from 2016 to 2017, it maybe went up a point or down a point, but it's pretty flat. And I'm wondering if part of the explanation for that is 2015 was the first time that the students took the SBAC. And so what you see, that large jump is, I don't know how much of it is related to the fact that now that you've taken it once, you understand the format, and that's for both the teachers and the students. So I'd be a little cautious about assuming that all of that gain is an academic gain rather than a gain in comfort and understanding of how the test is administered, because it's a very differently administered test than any other test that students have taken. There's a couple of things that I'm curious about, or that I'd like to talk about. One has to do with the district assessments. And I would agree that the district assessments give you a clue early on as to what's going on. And so I would really appreciate that those are also presented in a disaggregated format so that you can look at SED versus non-SED. If you're looking to close the gap and you're looking to target your LCAP programs, then you need to have that data as you're doing the programs. And it seems like that should be something that you can pull out of the data with all the databases you have. You know for each student whether they are SED or non-SED, and so that should be able to be pulled back out again. So that would be one recommendation I'd make. The other thing just has to do with more philosophy. There's school-dependent children versus non-school-dependent children. School-dependent children are those who have a home atmosphere in which either the parents are so stressed, they are uneducated, or they don't speak the language, are the three big ones that I've seen as a teacher, where they can't help their children with their homework. They can't help their children with a lot of the kinds of schoolworks and understanding and development. Okay. And so that kind of thing, I think, is really important for the school to realize that that's something that needs to be thought about and dealt with when you're looking at your, how are you spending your money at the detailed school level? How do you deal with, help with those children?
Thank you, Mrs. Neuhauser.
We are now moving along to our next item, which is item number 9.04, proposed revisions to board policy 5030, students and student wellness. It's the first reading and is being presented by Mrs. McGrath.
Thank you. This evening I bring before you a board policy, 5030, on student wellness. So typically a policy on student wellness would go through our district wellness committee. However, this revision was suggested due to a need related to a Safe Routes to Schools grant. So in this policy, you'll find two suggested revisions. The first revision came from your subcommittee on board policy. It adds some simplicity and clarity to the membership in our Student Health Council, which we do refer to as our wellness committee. A variety of stakeholders should be represented on our wellness committee, and these specific parameters and the requirements of the membership are followed by the wellness committee chairperson and membership. The second revision is a phrase that was suggested be added in order to better qualify for a grant. The suggestion seems very reasonable and acceptable, as it does spell out activities that are already happening in our schools. It asks that we encourage students to walk or bicycle to and from school, as well as in-class physical activities. Not only do we encourage movement before, during, and after school, we also understand the impact that activities and movement have on student mental, emotional, and physical wellness. Tonight, I ask that you consider approving this change during this first reading. I understand that our usual typical pattern is to bring revisions forward for a first reading and then to bring it back for a second reading in order to allow time for additional input. However, in this circumstance, since there are some fairly simple, maybe non-controversial revisions, and due to the fact that a grant application is impacted, I ask that you consider approving this tonight in our first meeting related to this. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the audience who would like to speak to this item? Mrs. Neuhauser. And just so everyone knows, do we set a three-minute timer on these answers?
I can't see the timer is the problem.
No, it doesn't. It's on.
Okay. It helps for me to know what my time framework is. But this is short.
I'll
be quick. Yeah, you can do that. Chris, that's fine. 1 minute, 2 minutes, that's fine.
Mrs. Neuhauser is there. There. Thank you, Mrs. Holmes.
Okay, now I can see it. My students think I have eyes on the back and side of my head, but I really don't. I'm just curious as to why you are taking out the requirement that you have parents, students, food service, administration, board, public in it, and just saying going to a... it will be diverse. Why are you taking out the specifics in this?
If I can.
We can't respond to Mrs. We'll talk. We're going to talk about it among ourselves.
I can respond to that. Yeah.
I think it's on the agenda, so I don't see why we can't respond. So this actually was my comment on this too, and because it's. Stakeholder representatives, because it's not a specific list, it's just saying stakeholders including, so it was my effort to allow us to include more groups than what are listed here. So it was my suggestion to just take it and make it a variety of stakeholders.
But I think if the language was requiring parents, students, food services as examples, no? So that it's not required to have... It wasn't required to have a parent, a student, somebody in each one of those categories? I'm sorry, I must have read it wrong. Okay.
So in my comments I mentioned that there are requirements that are followed by the wellness committee that are already spelled out. Some in the original you can see that it says consist of blank and then may consist of blank is the way it used to be worded. And our desire was to simplify that since it's followed. Titles change
people change. However, we would always follow the parameters that are already set forward. So this would, the suggestion was leave it as a variety of stakeholders so that it allows flexibility to pull in, as Mark said, even more people and people that have a desire and input on the Wellness Committee.
Mr. Quisenberry and then Mr. Unger.
So, Kim, you might be able to help me with this. As a portion of this grant, or is a portion of this grant directed at encouraging parents to encourage their children to walk and ride their bikes to school? And is part of the grant also identifying the safest routes to school? It appears to me, at least my observation at Los Osos Middle School, that a tremendous number of parents want to drive their child right up to the schoolhouse door. So do you have any idea whether this grant is encouraging parents to encourage their children to do the healthy thing and walk or ride their bike to school?
I believe it does, yes.
Okay.
I just want to thank Mrs. McGrath and Mrs. Primer for their explanation of what non-nutritious foods were. So I'm glad I'm cool with the changes, but I think what was more interesting to me was this notion that we will not serve non-nutritious foods, and especially what we call calorie-laden, essentially non-nutritious foods, which leads to childhood obesity. I believe that the work that particularly our food services group is doing is to be commended, to try to get kids to eat a wide variety of healthy foods and keeping essentially it's not called junk food, it's called non-nutritious foods out of our schools. So I just want to congratulate you guys and thank you guys for that.
Mrs. Roger.
Thank you. I just wanted to mention that Mrs. Neuhauser's time was kind of abruptly cut short by our attempt to respond to her question and what have you. I don't know if she had additional questions, but was that it? Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. So, do we, Mr. Buckman?
If we're ready to make a motion, yeah, I'd like to make a motion to approve the, board policy revisions to 5030 as presented tonight.
I'll second that.
We have a motion by Mr. Buckman and a second by Mr. Quisenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. It passes 7-0. Thank you.
Thank you.
6-0, Mr. Millar.
Oh, excuse me. That's it with absenting Mr. Millar. That's 6 with one abstention. We're now moving on to item number 9.05, approval notice of completion for Measure D.
Yeah, so we have two summer projects that have been completed. One was the Teach Fire Alarm. We brought the change orders to the board at our last meeting for approval in terms of looked at the overall cost of the projects and budgets. But the two projects that we're asking the board to now notice of completion that we're moving forward is the Teach Fire Alarm as well as the paint projects at Sunnyside, Sinchheimer, and Del Mar. So basically at the end of the project, when everything's complete, all the work has been done, we have to bring it back to the board to kind of put a final stamp so that subs can be notified, people can get paid, and rescission can be given out.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this item before we discuss? Seeing no one, Mrs. Sheffer.
I believe we discussed this in detail at the Measure D meeting the other day. So with having had that earlier discussion, I would move approval of 9.05, although it appears that my colleague, Mrs. Roger, may have a question.
I don't have a question. I'll just second your motion.
Okay. We have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer and a second by Mrs. Roger. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That passes 6-0 without Mr. Millar. And are you moving right on to 906 for us?
Very excited tonight to actually have a GMP to present to the board. So Mano Construction, but this lease-leaseback project. So some of the, besides the two high school priorities, right, San Luis Obispo High, Morro Bay High for Measure D focus, we have been doing other construction projects around around our campuses. And so one in particular was the C.L. Smith modernization. They didn't receive kind of the office modernization back with Measure A a long time ago. And so it's time for that school to kind of get this last finished touch. We've done the paint. We've done the kindergarten portable. So now it's kind of that office front look at for that school. So Mr. Holcomb and myself actually sat down with Manual Construction last week, kind of negotiated this point, got everything kind of lined up in terms of how the GMP was put together. So tonight, so again, lease-leaseback, we start with a resolution, which approves the board selecting the contractor. Then we brought you the actual contract documents, went through those. And then this next phase is kind of that guaranteed maximum price. And so that is the price that we're asking the board to approve that GMP tonight. This is a full office modernization at C.L. Smith, redoing the front of the campus, bus turnout, fencing around the front, you know, kind of that last piece of the facelift for this campus. Everybody's really looking forward to it. We hope to kind of have this even earlier to get started, but we're in line. The office staff has already been moved out, so as soon as this is approved, we're in the next couple of weeks, Manual Construction will begin that project on site.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this item? Seeing no one, Mr. Buckman.
Thanks. Ryan, just I think earlier we asked somebody to do the elevator speech version and just give us really. So I think just for the people that are going to watch this in the future, guaranteed price may sound just a little weird. So if you could just give a really short, maybe if you can do it, brief definition.
So basically, we select a contractor to kind of run the job. So that's part of best value, find a best value approach. So they have to tell us what their profit margin is, general conditions, bonding, insurance. And so based on those numbers, we select the contractor. They then go out and actually physically bid the job. So it's still kind of a low bid, getting people in, trying to get the lowest bids possible. They can still use best value, even for that. So if there's, you know, three firms and they're all within $100 in terms of the bids, and the one firm, again, as they go through all of their kind of requirements, their workforce, those types of things, they can still use best value even in selecting these. So we get to see all of that. We get a binder with all the bids, and then they have to go through it with us and explain who they chose and why they chose them and those types of things. 99% of the time, it's the low bid. So that process kind of happens, goes through, we go through everything. There's always one or two kind of items in the plans, in this case a block wall or things like that, that, you know, in terms of how that's physically going to work on the site. So there are a couple of allowances, relatively small. So those are things where they still have put a price on them, kind of like a bid, hey, this is the maximum that will cost. If it costs less, then we don't spend the allowance amount. And so that, so they're basically guaranteeing that it's going to come in at that price or below. That said, there's owner contingency there. So if there's some major thing that they find when they dig into the walls, even though they've gone in and checked and looked for hazardous, and in this case with lease-leaseback, which is nice, that they have done pre-construction agreements. So we basically paid them to look at all the plans, make sure that there's no issues. Dig in, make, you know, so that they check, which is very different than just a design bid build project where they don't get to see the plans necessarily up front. They bid them and move forward. So there's a lot of things to kind of stop change orders, make sure that relationship between the district and the contractor is a positive one.
Thank you. Well explained. Is there anyone else that would like to comment on this item? Is there anyone like to make a motion on this item?
Yeah, I'd be more than happy to move that we approve amendment number one to the lease-leaseback contract at C.L. Smith for the office expansion.
I'll second it.
A motion by Mr. Buckman, a second by Mr. Quisenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
And that passes 6-0 with Mr. Millar absent.
The superstars will be very, very excited to get this done.
We're moving on to the action consent agenda. If you have anything you would like to pull, please say so. 10.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 10.02, that was number one. 10.01, Mrs. Roger. Two, acceptance of donations, we're going to pull that for Mrs. Roger. 10.03, approval of furniture and equipment requests. And 10.04, approval.
Pull, please.
That's 10.04.
Please. I've got two polls.
Mr. Unger, okay, and Mr. Buckman. That was 10.4. So do I have a motion for 10.01 and 10.03?
I'll move approval of item 10.01 and 10.03.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Mrs. Scheffer. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That passes 6-0 with Mr. Millar absent. And then we have 10.02, Mrs. Roger.
That was mine. And
the reason I pulled it is because we see and we gratefully acknowledge donations at each board meeting in our board packets, but I don't know that we have ever said out loud, and so I want to take this opportunity, that each time we see donations received and targeted to specific schools through PG&E's campaign for the community that their employees participate in. And just for anyone who might be watching this program, who is a PG&E employee, who has the opportunity to participate and would like to, it's something that they can discuss with PG&E, how they might go about that, and it appears that they can designate any of our district schools to receive these funds. In the case of this board packet, we have monies going to Bishop Peach, Bishop's Peak, Laguna Middle School, and San Luis Obispo High School. But in other board packets, we do see contributions going to all of our schools at different times. So anyway, PG&E's campaign for the community benefits us. We gratefully acknowledge it and wanted to make people aware of it. And that said, I'll move approval of item 10.02.
We have a motion by Mrs. Rogers, seconded by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That passes 6-0 without Mr. Millar. And?
And I need to recuse myself on 10.04. There is a... Let's try that. There we go. I need to recuse myself on item 10.04. There was a CalCard purchase to CSBA.
Thank you.
I probably should recuse myself as well. So, Mike... the only reason I really pulled this meeting was because, as I look at these, I just want to note that given all the choices that we have for where to purchase goods for our students and for the schools and for the teachers, we continue to use local businesses, and so we're supporting the community. And I mean, we just like a lot of people are shopping around, we continue to shop locally.
Would you like to make a motion?
So in light of that, I'd like to move approval of 10.04.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Mr. Buckman and seconded by Mrs. Scheffer on 10.04. All in favor? Aye. And that's passes 6-0. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, it's 5-0 without Mr. Unger and without Mr. Millar. And moving on to item number 11.01. Well, we did that, sorry. And the advanced agenda. Does anyone have anything for the advanced agenda they'd like to bring up at this time? And moving on to board reports. Mrs. Scheffer.
I attended last week together with Mr. Unger and Dr. Eisendrath Rogers and Mr. Buckman and a couple of principals and Dr. Prater, the hearings held by the California Public Utilities Commission regarding the joint agreement with PG&E. And it was interesting, and we will await the decision by the administrative law judge, which hopefully will be in our favor and arriving in the not-too-distant future so we can know what our budget looks like. I'm sure Mr. Pinkerton is waiting for that decision. There were many members from the community at large who are affected by the closure at Diablo. There were a couple of public hearings held in the same day to accommodate schedules, and I attended both, and they were very interesting to hear what people had to say. I also wanted to point out that this Friday evening at Cuesta, there is a free event on an information session presented by the Latina Leadership Network at Cuesta College, which will be an event called Sharing the Dream, Supporting Undocumented Students and Their Families. Mm-hmm. It's a bilingual event with dinner included. It's from 4 to 8 p.m. Again, there's no charge. There will be workshops for parents and students, a presentation by the Mexican consulate, and Blanca Figueroa, representing Congressman Salud Carbajal, will be there. So anyone watching, if you're interested in attending that event, it should be interesting and have a lot of helpful information.
Mrs. Shepard, would you be so kind as to repeat the place and time?
Sure. It is held at the Cultural and Performing Arts Center at Cuesta College, Friday, September 22nd, from 4 to 8 p.m. Free parking in Lot 2, and it is open to the general public. There's no need for reservations or anything like that. People can just attend.
Excellent. Thank you. Mr. Buckman.
I think Mr. Unger's light was on.
That's okay. Go ahead, Mark.
Okay, thanks. So I just have probably about 20 things I want to mention, but I'll just keep it down to 7. I was able to attend the San Luis High School back-to-school night with Mr. Millar, and it was very well done. I think the parents walked away with a lot of good information. I attended the Central Coast Committee for Inclusive Schools. This is a group that was originally and continues to work to review areas in the public schools for inclusivity for LGBTQ students. And one of the things that came up at this most recent meeting was the possibility of this group also monitoring and watching for inclusivity of students with disabilities. So I think it's really nice that they're going to be moving on to that. I was able to attend an all-day Friday and Saturday workshops put on by the California School Boards Association called Masters in Governance, along with Mrs. Sheffer and Mrs. Rogers, and I found it really, really helpful. It was mentioned earlier about the 9/11 memorial event. I particularly want to call out the fact that in these events in the future, the decisions have been made to feature students and not politicians, which I think is great. So this year, we had the Girls State attendee Augusta Holyfield and our Boys State winner that went to Boys State, Oliver Hicks. And let me see, the middle school, Laguna Middle School's poet, and I have her name here, Audrey Broder. So just a shout out to them. They did a great job, and it was really good. And this is just, this is going to be a little advertisement for anybody that's watching. Saturday, the NAACP held their annual event in J2, which is the room where we normally do our board meetings, and just left it. They were in awe of it. The kitchen, the audiovisual capabilities, the great balcony with probably the best view of San Luis. And again, I'm mentioning this for the public because we got great facilities in the school district, and I'm hoping more and more groups will take advantage of them because they do help offset some of our costs. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Beckman, Mr. Quisenberry.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to report back on the success of the Family Fun Fair on Grandparents' Day. That was September 10th. And mention that the beneficiaries of that, in addition to the Los Osos Rotary Club, will be the music boosters of Morbay High School. Dance Fusion performed, and they'll be a beneficiary of that, and also the Morbay High cheerleaders. So we appreciate their participation, and next year we hope to gain maybe the choir back. Thank you.
Mr. Unger.
So I was able to, and I was hosted by the staffs and the principals at Del Mar Los Osos Middle School in Baywood. It's great to be able to go around and, again, just see the wonderful teaching that's happening in our classrooms. I'm taking an adult school Spanish class. And so Wednesday nights I'm going over to Morro Bay High School and I'm starting to maybe learn a little Spanish. It's really fun, and I appreciate the adult school, so kind of a shout out to them. Speaking of shout outs, Monday night is the Teacher of the Year and the Classified Employee of the Year dinner. We have two great people that are being honored. So, you know, we've introduced them before, and just we're so lucky to have the staff that we've got. And I want to give a shout out to Mr. Quisenberry over here, who just for your commitment to Morro Bay High School and Morro Bay High School athletics. I think you go to every football game. You know, you're out there supporting the school. So just keep, like I say, a shout out to you.
I'll just add that I'm also taking Spanish, but at the Slo High School Adult School, so we'll have to hablo español. But it just goes to show that education is ongoing.
Es rapido.
Rapido.
That too. Thank you. We'll be meeting again on October 3rd at our regular place back at the J2 at the San Luis Coast Unified School District headquarters. Thank you. Good night.
Good morning. Robin and Brooke are taking.
They're not there.
So what night are you going?
Monday.
Oh, they're Thursday.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Oh, I would know. I definitely. So but there are other people there.
Do you have?